Everybody's still asleep. Good morning. Hey, there we go. All right. You made it to Friday morning. So I'm Matt Usher. I'm a program manager at Microsoft. I specifically work on Azure SQL Data Warehouse. I was one of the PMs originally involved with the inception of the product, so I've been around since the very beginning. This is an interactive session, so if you have questions as we go, just raise your hand. I'll repeat the question for the recording, but feel free to ask questions as we go. I can stand here and talk for an hour and a half easily enough, but usually you get a lot more out of it. If there's something that you're interested in, or if I cover something very quickly and you want more detail, or you have a question about how something works, feel free to just stop and ask me questions. So I'll also have time afterwards. I'll hang out a little bit, so if you have additional questions, feel free to kind of catch me then. So we'll start with a couple questions. So how many of you know what SQL Data Warehouse is? Oh, okay, that's better than I usually get. That's awesome. How many of you are running a SQL Data Warehouse today? Okay, so a few. Okay. So we'll talk about kind of, in this session's a little bit of an overview, and I'll walk through kind of some of the details, and then I'll talk about some scenarios you can use SQL Data Warehouse with. And there's a couple interactive demos. I'll show you kind of how to put it together, so a couple of best practices, and then I'll show you this actually running at scale, kind of what that looks like. So when we think about kind of why Microsoft built Azure SQL Data Warehouse, it's really a response to this explosion of kind of data. That we're at this point where pretty much everything that you own is speaking to the internet and producing data. I mean, it's pretty amazing the amount of devices that are emitting data that you can now use as a business to get insight into your customers, into your competitors, and, you know, kind of new opportunities that are starting to emerge. It's not unheard of to think about companies now that are taking data from things like, you know, gas meters or all of this IoT device that they're putting on, say, mining equipment or connected devices in all kinds of different ways and being able to take that data and get insight out of their customers. Or they're taking things that they already had, assets that they already had, and are combining those assets into ways that present new business opportunities, deeper learning of customers, being able to predictively maintain equipment, for example, or to understand, you know, what a competitor's doing and how to respond to that in, you know, very quick order. So not only kind of waiting for all of that data to be, you know, surfaced, analyzed, and all of that, but being able to take advantage of it and interact and respond to it in near real time. But because you have this explosion of data, you need big services to be able to absorb all of that data and to be able to compute through it very quickly to get you that insight. And that's where a service like Azure SQL Data Warehouse was born. It was this idea that you're going to have to be able to rapidly ingest data. You're going to have to be able to, you know, query across all of that data, get the insight out of it, using tools that you're already familiar with, so not inventing something new. So when we think about kind of that demand, you see that there's a set of analysts that have talked about data warehousing and data assets in general as just kind of one of the growth areas. 451 Research also talks about how not only, you know, these unstructured data stores, things like Hadoop, but these very structured data stores are going to explode over the next 5 to 10 years. And the demand for skill sets in this arena is really critical for being able to take all of that data and really kind of move businesses forward. It's no longer, you know, situations where companies are able to wait to get that data, to be able to interact with that data in a way that, you know, maybe takes days or weeks or months because their competitors aren't. And the market is now moving so rapidly, being able to join things in ways that you never really could before or weren't thinking about before. There's a company in the U.S., a retailer, who combines things like all of their sales data, some information they get about, you know, the marketplace in general from industry trade groups, and they combine that with weather data. And they found interesting patterns in that combination of data that now that they can change their business. They can do things like on-demand pricing for, you know, different weather conditions. So if it's going to be a hot streak, they can actually price their products very rapidly differently than they would if it was going to be, say, you know, a stormy season. And so they can do that based on what they're getting out of this real-time information of just simply weather. And they can see the impact of weather on their online shopping and be able to make business decisions based on that kind of combined data. So being able to have access to all this data is really critical. Excuse me. So when we think about SQL Data Warehouse, it's really built on three pillars. If you've been around SQL Data Warehouse, you've probably heard this once or twice. But it's really kind of on these three pillars, the first one being elastic scale and performance. And the idea is that, you know, this is a service that can scale to multiple petabytes. You can get very, very large with the service, but you don't have to start there. And the service can just grow with you. So if you start with a terabyte, for example, you don't have to worry about having headroom. Can the service get to a petabyte if I ever get there as a business? Or as I bring on new data sources into my environment, can I pull in that data and be able to access it? It's an MPP-based system. So does everybody know what MPP is? Anybody not know? It's okay to admit. All right, so we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But the idea is that it's a divide and conquer methodology. It uses scale out clustering technologies to be able to process all of this data very, very rapidly. It has instant on compute. So one of the key assets of the service is that we divided the concept of compute and storage. This means that they can grow independently of each other. You don't have to pre-allocate an amount of storage. And the service can grow independently. And this comes into play with a lot of customers. You know, we have a customer who uses the service once a month. They're an industry analyst, and they get a bunch of data once a month from their industry partners. They take all of that data. They process it very heavily over the course of about 5-6 days. They run some analytic reports, and they turn the service off. They can actually save compute by just removing compute from the equation. And they can do that very quickly. It takes about 60 seconds to resize the cluster, in this case, all the way to zero. And so this ability to kind of define the service in a way that is non-traditional. We see customers doing things like scaling the service on demand when they need it. Traditionally in a data warehouse, data loading is kind of a computationally intensive operation. And so we'll see customers then start to load data in the morning, and right before they do, they scale the cluster up to a much larger size, process all of their data very quickly, and then scale it back down because they don't need all that compute power for, say, serving a dashboard. So they're able to do that very, very quickly. And then finally, this concept of querying relational and non-relational data. One of the key kind of components of what's happening today is, and I get asked this a lot, is, you know, well, what about Hadoop? You know, what about all this unstructured data? What can I do with it? In the past, services had always built into this kind of model that you have to land everything in the system that you're in, kind of these closed systems. And that would mean that you would go build expensive ETL processes. You would have SSIS or Informatica or Tunity or any one of these loading tools that take your data from one location and put it into another. Today, when we start talking volumes of data, if you've ever tried to move a terabyte from one place to another, like, you know, a very large file on your laptop, you watch the, you know, the Windows copying dialog come up, and it takes forever. When we start talking about things in, you know, tens and hundreds of terabytes, moving data is very, very expensive, very hard, very costly. And so we've introduced a technology called Polybase that allows you to query both structured and semi-structured data in data sources like Hadoop, Azure Data Lake, those kinds of assets. So you can combine all this data in simple T-SQL format and query the data and be able to access it very quickly. And I'll actually show you that in a little bit. The second is obviously it's powered by the cloud. One of the biggest components of all of these cloud services running is that they're fully managed. SQL DW is no different. It's a fully managed service, which means Microsoft takes on the responsibility of patching and upgrading and securing the core environment. And that really gets you back to your business. I've never, ever heard, I talked to lots of customers, and I've never, ever heard anybody say, my boss cares about how many cores we run to get an answer to a business question. When your boss comes in, they want to know, hey, what did we do last quarter? What's happening in this region? And instead, what we focused on in these kinds of, you know, businesses and data warehousing specifically, is we take that question and we turn it into a series of follow-on questions. Well, what's your pain threshold? How fast do you have to load data? Well, how fast do you have to have access to it? What's your growth pattern look like? And all of a sudden, this conversation turns into, well, you need to buy this number of cores. You need to buy these kinds of disks. You need to have this kind of backup infrastructure. And all of a sudden, we've gotten you away from what you really are supposed to be doing, which is focusing on how to grow your own business. Most people aren't in the data center business. There's very few companies that are now doing this at very large scale, Microsoft being one of them. And so allowing all of the experts who are really good at things like how do we lay down security patches over, say, a couple million servers. You know, there's a team of people who are very good at that. So we've removed all of that pain and allow you to focus back on how do you get insight out of that data. With SQL DW, you can go light up a cluster in just a couple minutes. For those that have, you can see that it's pretty easy. We go light up kind of any infrastructure and size you want. You can light up these very fast. You can start interacting with it very quickly. As a cloud service running in the Azure cloud, one of the components is the integration of this service with all of the other services. So when we think about SQL Data Warehouse, as much as I love this product, as much as I care intimately about it, it's only a part of a solution. So we start talking about things, you know, as part of your solution. Where does your data come from? Where's that data born? That's part of the solution. How do you move the data into places so that it's accessible for analytics, storage, computing? That's another part of your solution. How do you visualize the data? How do you monitor those solutions? And how do you secure all of that? Those are all components of the solution that you're building. And so when you think about that, making it very simple to integrate with all these other services. And as part of the Azure cloud, you can go very quickly and light up something like Azure ML, the machine learning program, and be able to run predictive analytics or any kinds of analytics kind of methodologies that you like, you can go right up there and have simple access to be able to get data in from Azure SQL Data Warehouse, say score the data, and push that scoring result right back into Azure SQL Data Warehouse. And it's all something you can do through a browser. You don't even have to write code pretty much anymore. Simple integrations to things like Azure Data Factory for being able to pipeline data from place to place if you need to do that. And so making all of those kind of integrations very, very simple. And then finally, from a price and performance perspective. So I can tell you my team spends a lot of time focused really on trying to make sure that we do two things, that the service is constantly reliable for you. And Azure SQL Data Warehouse is the only service in the industry that will provide an SLA. Today, we offer an availability SLA of 4.9, 99.99%. That means that we focus a lot of our time on things like reliability and security and management of the services. And then we focus a lot on performance, making sure that you're getting the most value that you can from the service. So we've introduced a bunch of technologies, things like clustered column store indexing at scale, updatable column stores, secondary indexes over clustered column store tables, all of these things to give you the best benefit from this product that you can get. So I'm going to pivot back to that conversation or that question I asked, which is SMP versus MPP. And I have a very simple analogy. But really, when we talk about these two different kind of approaches, they're really kind of a definition of architectures of building a system. So if you think of a traditional SMP system, your laptop, maybe a traditional server that you'd have sitting in your data center, it's a shared architecture. So you have some shared component inside of it, whether that's the operating system, say, in the picture here, we have a shared bus where you're sharing kind of access to disks. But really, it means that you have some resource contention. Now, these systems are getting good. For many years, we had Moore's Law that showed us things like processors will double in performance every 18 months. And we got to a point where we stopped having that capability. So we moved on from individual processor speeds to multi-cores. We went from single cores to double, dual cores to quad cores and so on. But that only gets you to a certain point. The MPP model is truly completely independent components running in parallel. And the idea is that because you're not sharing anything, you can divide work and share it that amount of work that you're going to do across a large number of components that can run in parallel. And it's that parallelism that gives power. And so we can talk about kind of what that means. For a customer that we had just recently, they had bought a SQL Server installation on a single SQL box, physical server. They had a SAN behind it. Pretty big setup. They had about 40 terabytes of data in it. And they were running these analytics queries. And they had a particular query that they were running over. It took them about 7 days to run the query, pretty big analytics query, trying to analyze all of this data. And sometimes it wouldn't complete in 7 days, so they'd have to kill it and restart it at the beginning of a Sunday morning because it took so long. We took that exact environment, did nothing but lift the environment, move it into an MPP environment, and we're able to take that query from 7 minutes or 7 days to 37 minutes just by doing nothing but picking it up and moving. And the power of being able to distribute that work across multiple nodes meant that the system could move very, very rapidly over that set of data. So it's a great example of that. The analogy I usually always give people who don't have kind of a background in this is, imagine that, there's a few of us here in a room. Imagine we have a pile of wood sitting on the floor in front of us, and we have a hammer and some nails. We're going to build a wall. So traditionally in an SMP architecture, what we would do is, I'd pick up the hammer, grab a piece of wood, grab a nail, hit the nail. Then I'd walk to the first person, give them the hammer, they'd go do the same operation. And we would work our way through the room until we got all of this done. Now, in SMP, what's happened is that we've introduced multi-cores and faster cores. So maybe with faster cores, maybe instead of a hammer, we got a nail gun. So, pop, you can do it pretty fast. But, we're still kind of sharing all of this stuff. So maybe we got multi-cores. So maybe we got four nail guns or a quad core now. So we can go kind of pretty fast. In an MPP world, what it means is instead of each one of us kind of having to share that hammer, that air gun, or a nail gun, instead we have a pile of lumber, and everybody in the room has a hammer and a nail. There's one person coordinating it. They say, you ready? Go. Bam. Done. And so that power of being able to distribute all of the work and do it in parallel means that we can now operate much, much faster. Even though we have the same problem, we're trying to build, a simple wall with some wood, some hammer, and some nails. Being able to do that in parallel and coordinate the activity is really how you can take things like a petabyte of data and process it very fast. And so being able to get insight out of that. Now, not everybody has a petabyte of data. Anybody have a petabyte of data in the room? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, with the MMP, do you always scale out, or do you scale up in each node and out?
So with MPP, do you scale both up and out is really the question. Generally, the first avenue is to scale wide. These systems generally kind of scale horizontally. And the reason being is most of the time these systems are built with kind of simple commodity hardware. They're not really specialized hardware, very big. Our system today doesn't allow you to scale up vertically on an individual node, more scale wide. But that is something that we've been looking at as kind of a different component. How do you scale larger on an individual node? Really, generally, by adding more nodes, you can offer more processing than you can by scaling up individual nodes. It's generally kind of the rule of thumb. Now, these, you know, MPP systems are no different than, you know, you see in this case in SQL Data Warehouse. But this is a methodology that's been around for a long time. It's not something that was just introduced by us. It's something that a lot of systems use. If you look at Hadoop, for example, it's the same exact concept. It's this divide and conquer methodology that allows, you know, the data to be processed very, very fast. And as we kind of start through this, so one of the things to think about is how the system is built. So I keep referring to it as Azure SQL Data Warehouse. What most people don't realize is under the covers, this is the same set of components that run both the Azure SQL Data Warehouse business as well as the Azure SQL Database business. It's actually the same services under the covers. So it's a variant of SQL Server 16. So just like you would imagine, we released, you know, SQL Server 2016 in the public late last year. And then we continue to iterate on top of that. And so the delivery and the efficiency that we have is the ability to take what we have in our SQL assets and land that across all of our services. So things like commonality between them. We're able to introduce features that we can learn from all of these millions of databases we have running in the cloud and be able to apply that to all of our assets. But because it's SQL Server, it means that we have the capability of doing all of the things that you would expect. We can include a lot of the partners that we have in the SQL Server ecosystem to work with SQL DW very, very quickly. And this is just a short list. There's quite a few partners that we have. So from a data warehousing perspective, you can think of all the things that you would expect. So all of your data loading tools, monitoring tools, you know, all of your visualization tools. So as well as, you know, what you would expect from the Microsoft assets. So Power BI obviously works with the service. But if you don't have Power BI, and specifically in data warehousing, I've never met a single customer who says, I only run Microsoft stuff. There's always something in there, whether that's a Tableau as a front-end service, or that's Informatica for loading data, or some third-party tool for monitoring. There's always some environment. So we've taken special care to have deep partnerships with all of these companies to make sure that their products and services work very, very well with SQL Data Warehouse. And that sometimes means that we make changes to our product to accommodate something that one of our partners needs, or likely the partner will also make a change to their product to accommodate SQL Data Warehouse, kind of some of the uniqueness that it presents. And so really having this broad ecosystems means that you can take your environment from where you are, say on-premise, and shift it to the cloud fairly easily. Lastly, I'm going to introduce this concept. So how many people know what Polybase actually is? So a few. Looks like the same people who are running SQL Data Warehouse. So we introduced a technology called Polybase about 4 years ago. And what Polybase is it's the capability of querying both structured and semi-structured data in SQL Server in something like Hadoop or Azure Blob Storage or Azure Data Lake. And the idea is that customers have this data landing in different places, and they're able to combine that data and get insight. I'll give you a real example of this. As you can tell by my accent, I'm from the U.S. I live in Southern California, just south of Los Angeles. And in the U.S., there's a company called Progressive Insurance. What they do is they insure people driving cars. And they have this program where they give you this little dongle, you plug it into your car, and it takes telemetry out of your car and records that. And the premise behind it is, if you give us some data about you, we can customize a policy specifically about your driving habits and not you, just you in general. So, you know, I'm an early 40s guy, I live in Los Angeles, I have an Audi, so that kind of defines who I am. And in the past, what would happen is the insurance companies would employ all these mathematicians to do risk assessments against me and come up with a formula as to who I am. But that doesn't mean I'm like every other person who's 40 years old, lives in Southern California, and drives an Audi, right? Like, that may be completely off of to how I drive, where I drive, how often I drive, those kinds of things. And so what Progressive does is they take that structured data. Hi, my name's Matt. This is my insurance policy. This is where I live, the type of car I drive. And they combine it with all of that telemetry that they're getting out of that device. Now, that device data goes and doesn't land in SQL Data Warehouse. It lands in a Hadoop cluster sitting in their environment, so they have it on-premise. And it's just telemetry information. You can imagine these are, you know, any types of information that you can expect, web logs. In this case, happens to be this telemetry on this device. Now, they were absorbing all of this, and they weren't really sure what they could do with it. They were just kind of looking at it, and they were absorbing it, and they were thinking, well, at some point, we really have to figure out how to do something interesting with this data that we hadn't really thought of before. You know, they can kind of customize my policy. But about 3-4 years ago in the U.S., we all of a sudden started seeing services like Uber and Lyft, and these driving services. And what happened from an insurance company perspective is this put great strain on the way that they sell policies. If you're an insurer, they started to look at this data and think, well, you know, what happens if we have somebody who's participating in the action of basically being a taxi driver or a limousine driver? And how do we insure that? So what they did was they went through and they tried to figure out, well, who looks like a driver that is an Uber driver, and how can we build specially crafted policies for them? And so what they did was they ran a simple query. They said, go find me all of the people who have a non-commercial policy, someone like me, who went to the airport 5 times this week. Because I don't know about you, I don't go to the airport that often, right? Or maybe 5 times today, or drove at particular times of the day. And they were able to combine that information, and they basically built a marketing list. They took that to their marketing team and said, here's a bunch of our customers, or former customers, who look like one of these kinds of drivers. And we've crafted special programs for them, part-time Uber drivers, full-time Uber drivers, that allow them to go get specific policies that cover them for things like a passenger in the back seat as a commercial driver. And they were able to use the power of a simple T-SQL statement, select star from table where, and join that with data that said, where did this action? And that where did this action comes from that log data that's now sitting in Hadoop. I'll show you how this works in just a minute using blob storage, but the idea is that Polybase as an engine can take that information, make a decision based on the data that's sitting in something like a Hadoop cluster, be able to either just stream the data back or create a MapReduce job automatically for you and push that into Hadoop and stream the results back and combine that with SQL. And because it's based on the SQL language, it becomes very familiar. We use the concept of a table just like we would in SQL Server. And we can represent data in a Hadoop cluster with a table and be able to merge that data. And because you're able to do this, you don't have to think about, well, do I have to go get all that data? How do I ETL that data? How do I load it? How do I parse it? How do I get it ready so that I can make these kinds of answers? And once you've done that, then you become into this very kind of inflexible structure. Well, what if you get a new asset of information in those logs? How do you go get that information very fast? Oh, well, I have to change my ETL processes. I have to reload the data. We start talking about things in tens of terabytes. That could take days. You're that farther behind in answering the question of how do I go run my business? So I'm going to pivot over to actually walking you through, kind of setting one of these up. So we'll flip over to SSMS here. And this is connected to just a simple demo instance. There's nothing in it today, so this is just a SQL DW instance that that I use for demos. And we'll walk you through the process of showing you how we create kind of the structure of a SQL data warehouse and some of the kind of the differences that you would expect from something like SQL Server. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to create a table. And I want to call out kind of the differences here of what's happening in the system. And I'll kind of explain as I go along what's going on here. Uh-oh. Hold on. It looks like what I'm seeing and what you're seeing are two different things. Let's try to duplicate and see if you can see what I see. There we go. So really, this is the same structure as you would create for, say, any kind of SQL Server instance. So you want to go create a table, in this case, just a simple customers table. But there's a couple of key pieces of information sitting at the bottom that are really important. I'm going to do these in reverse order. So the bottom is the indication of what type of index to create for this table. Now, Microsoft has introduced what we call cluster column store indexes. This essentially means that we're storing your data vertically based on the column and not horizontally based on the row. And the distinction here is that generally in data warehouses, you'll have tables that have hundreds of columns. It's really common that you have a large fact table, say orders, and has a set of columns. And oftentimes when you process that data, you're not processing all of the columns. And by using columns, we can break that data down into chunks. We call them segments. And we can allocate segments as, here's a range of data that sits in that segment. Now, when we run a query, we can do what's called segment elimination. So if I do something like, show me all the people, in this case, who has a last name starting with U. And I can walk through the SQL Server engine can walk through the segments and eliminate all of the segments that don't have a last name starting with U. And the reason this is important is because if you think of something like a database that has, say, you know, 100 million rows, 500 million rows, a billion rows, we start to get these large volumes, then you can start to eliminate the I.O. And this is where the magic of the system happens. So by not having to pull the data off disk, we can process through it much faster, and we can reduce query processing time. So this is one of the common kind of default behaviors that we have in the service. I've explicitly called it out here, But really what it means is that you by default will get that index. Now we do support other indexing types. We support clustered indexes, so you can create a row store index similar as you could in SQL Server. We also allow for you to create what's called a heap table, which is essentially a table with no index, so you can create those as well. The second part is what you see is called the distribution model. Now, I don't have a graphic of this because I'm going to just visually explain this. And the way that we run our system is we break all of the data that you have in what's a visual table or a logical table into a bunch of chunks. We call them distributions. You can think of them as a shard. And the idea is that in order to make each one of the processing components work in parallel, they only need to work on a part of the data. And so we do this automatically. The part that you get to control is the methodology used to break that data apart. And today we currently support two types. We support what's called a round-robin distribution. So you can imagine that's exactly what it sounds like. So today we run 60 distributions, and so in a round-robin format, you can imagine row 1 gets put on distribution 1, row 2 gets put on distribution 2, row 3 on 3, row 4 on 4, until we get to 60. Then we start again. Row 61 gets put on distribution 1. It just works in a round-robin fashion, kind of consistently laying data across the environment. Now, it doesn't work exactly like that, but that's basically the concept behind it. We try to evenly lay the data down. Now, that works if you're having kind of a wide set of data, and that's a default behavior in SQL Data Warehouse. And the idea is that we want to get you into this distributed methodology without really having to understand it. So it gives you some of the performance, but not fully all of the performance that you would expect. The second, then, model is what we call a hash distribution. And you can see that kind of laid out here. And the idea is that we take the column that you're identifying, we hash that, and we put like rows on the same nodes. Now, the thing I haven't told you in the Achilles heels of all these MPP systems is that anytime you have to move data, it starts to become a problem. So you want to do everything you can to minimize data. And so in this case, I'm just hash distributing on an ID column because at some point later, I'm going to join on that. It's a good kind of candidate for a key to start with your distribution model. Group bys are also something else you could consider. But really, the idea is that as that data is being processed, you have a node that's focused on a set of data that's in a particular range, and it can process that data very fast. And so when you start to divide that, you think about this in kind of common or human terms. Say we have this column that was, say, based on region. Say we have 60 regions. Each database under the covers, each distribution under the covers, would only be processing one region. And it gives that system a very efficient way to access all of the data in that region and process it very quickly. So if you're doing elimination, each one of the nodes can work very, very fast in parallel. And so this is kind of the distribution model. In this case, I'm simply going to create a simple table, and I'm going to add some data to it. So we'll create the table first. And then I'm going to go insert some data. So pretty straightforward. Simple singleton insert, just like you would expect. And so this will go insert a single row. And just like you'd expect, I can go query the data and I can get it right back out. Now, all of what's happening here under the covers is in the select statement, for example. So just like the hammer and nails analogy, we create a distributed plan. So what's happening is I've created the select star from customers statement, and as the controller, I've sent that message out to each one of the individual nodes as a distributed query plan. So each one of the nodes is now operating on that set of instructions as a SQL Server instance. So just like you would imagine that I'm just connected to a single box, select star from table, it's just returning results based on a local SQL instance. In this case, those results are aggregated back on what we call a head node, basically the person coordinating all the traffic here, and aggregated and sent back to the customer. In this case, you know, you can see it took about just a second for that entire process to happen. In this case, we're running a DW1000, which is a 10-node system. So I just asked 10 nodes to go perform work, and it performed very quickly for me. So now we're going to move on to kind of a different model of loading data. So we're going to start with the concept of how to create Polybase to go load data out of some other source. And I'm going to walk you through what this looks like and how to load data and some of the reasons why you do this. So I'm going to start by creating a master key. By default here, I didn't give it a password, but this really is the way that then all of the next steps, when we secure things like the credentials I'm about to use to go connect to that blob data, this is how it's encrypted. So you can control the password for encrypting all of that data. The next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to create what's called a database scope credential. And essentially, this is the user that I'm going to use to go connect to, in this case, storage, to be able to access that data. In this instance, we're going to use blob storage. I have a file sitting up there that I'm going to go read. So I have to have some credential to be able to go access that. And so it's just like you'd expect. This is the secret for my storage key, or for my storage account. So I'm just going to create the credential. And then I'm going to move on to explaining to the system what structure that data is in. In this case, it's a pretty straightforward file. It's a comma delimited file sitting in blob storage. So I'm going to tell it, you know, it's a delimited text, and here's the delimiter. So pretty straightforward. You have quite a few options here. You can configure things like row terminators and field terminators, date formats, those kinds of things. So I'm going to create this. And from here, the last thing we need to do is tell it where to go get the data. So we're going to create what's called a data source. Now you can see there's some options here. You can see that it's defining a type called Hadoop. That's generally the default behavior that we have. We're telling it the location. This is my actual blob storage. So this is just my account, my blob container sitting in the Azure cloud. And then I'm going to tell it how do I connect with what credentials. So I'm simply going to connect or create one of these data sources. Again, it takes just a second. Now the last thing we're going to do is we're going to create what we call an external table. And the only time that you'll know that this is an external table is in the create DDL. So in this case, we have a special syntax, create external table. Now you do the same thing that you would expect. You define rows and columns, or columns and data types, nullability capabilities of each column. And then we have this special syntax on the bottom. The location in this case happens to be the file. So this is the actual file. It's sitting in my blob storage. You can see it's up in that same storage system that we were just looking at. So this is Storage Explorer. And it's just a file. And I have it pulled locally, so you can kind of see what it looks like. In this case, it's pretty simple. It's just an ID and a GUID. Pretty simple, but just to get the kind of concept across of what we're actually doing with it. So if we go back to SSMS, you can see I have those two columns. And I'm giving it a location which says target this file. Now, we also have the capability of doing what we call directory transversal. So in the case of, like, the common case is something like a web log. So I have a structure that looks something like this in my directory. I start with, say, maybe a year, so 2017. Then maybe I have month directories underneath that, say, January. Then under that I have date directories, say, the 1st of January. And under that maybe I have a bunch of my log files. So maybe I'm running 10 web servers and each one is emitting a log file per day into that location. Instead of targeting a specific file, I could also target, say, 2017. Or even if there's a directory above that, say, weblogs, I can create that as my source of table. And as Polybase processes, it'll actually cascade through the entire directory, bring everything underneath it, pulling it into the table. So I can represent the infrastructure both ways. In this case, I'm going to target a specific file. I'm going to tell it what the source was, which contains the credential, and I'm going to tell what the format of the files are. So I'll go ahead and create this. And now I'm going to just run a count out of that. And while this is processing, what's happening is the SQL DW engine has asked the Polybase engine to go out, read that file that you saw sitting in blob storage. In this case, it's just going to stream it back. It read all of the file in parallel. Because it's in blob storage, we can read it in chunks. So we have 10 nodes reading that file in chunks. They split the file up. They're read in parallel, streamed. In this case, the rows are counted, and those aggregates are sent back to the control node, and then they're shown back to the customer. So in this case, the caller, which is SSMS. And that all took, I don't know, just a couple of seconds. In this case, it looks like about 2 seconds to go get a count of about 300,000 rows. So it happens very rapidly. We're able to use this parallelism of the system to be able to go read that very fast. And then so you can start to build from there. So now the next thing is, if we start to think about kind of how do we move data around in the system. This is one of the unique things about SQL Data Warehouse. When we start to think of these MPP systems, you want to start to think about doing things in batch operations. The reason you want to do this is you start to use the parallelism of all of these nodes. So in something like earlier, you saw me do something like an insert statement. So an insert statement. What's happening is, in that case, I'd go to an individual node and insert a row. Well, I have 10 nodes sitting there, so 9 of the nodes are kind of twiddling their thumbs bored. They're not doing anything. So we start to think about doing things very rapidly. So it's often more common to see customers do something like create a new table and rename as a faster operation against a billion rows than it is something to do like an update statement against that same table, because you get the power of moving all of that data around in parallel. Now, this is a new syntax. If you're not familiar with SQL DW, we call them CTAS statements, or create table as select. And the idea is I'm going to go generate a new table from an existing table. In this case, I'm going to take all of that data that was sitting in that blob file, and I'm going to pull it into SQL Data Warehouse. This is also a way that you can load data very rapidly. One of the things I want to call out is you can see that I'm actually changing the data type. So I'm going to cast this particular column into a unique identifier instead of having it as an NVARCHAR table or an NVARCHAR column. So you have all of the capabilities of changing that data. You can do things like aggregating data into materialized views or materialized tables for optimum performance for like a dashboard, for example. And you can see I've defined a different kind of structure here. I'm going to hash distribute again on ID, but I'm giving it a different index type, in this case a heap. So I'm going to go ahead and do this. Now what's happening right now is the system has generated a new table, it's gone back out, read all of those rows in that file, and pulled them into SQL Data Warehouse. And it was able to do that in just a second or two. In this case, about 300,000 rows. It did it fairly fast. We can process data in the ranges of, depending on your configuration, 3 to 15 terabytes an hour by pulling in data in this fashion. So we can load data very, very rapidly into the system very quickly. So now if I go down and I actually want to go see what's in that, you can see I'm now using my local table, and I went and grabbed the first, say, 100 rows. And so this, again, created a distributed query against the local data now instead of going out to that external file and returned that very fast to me. So I was able to get through that data very quickly. Now the last thing I'm going to do is you can go and create kind of these join tables. And I'm not going to do it here because it takes a little bit of time. I want to get to kind of some other parts of this. But you can see that you can take things like all of this join data, and I can create views, for example, and I can join all of those different kinds of columns. In this case, I'm using some contrived examples of being able to pull things from both internal and external sources. But the idea is once you've created a table, whether it's external or not, the system works and interacts with it just like it's any other SQL table. So things like permissioning is allowed, security is allowed, joins are allowed. All of those kinds of operations that you would expect are capable on these external tables, giving you the power of being able to use data that both is resident in the system as well as external from the system when you're building out your solution. It's a great question. So I'll repeat the question. So I'm trying to make sure I get this back running here. The question is, what's the best practice around when do you use an external table and when do you use a local table and pull that data in for processing? So I used to be a Big Five consultant. I got paid a lot of money for this answer. It depends. It really does depend. It depends on kind of the volume of data more than anything else. If you're able to connect to a Hadoop cluster, and the data set in the Hadoop cluster is fairly large, but you can manage that by, say, predicates, a where clause, for example. It's okay to leave the data there as long as the result sets aren't that big. If you're going to try to move, you saw me move a couple hundred thousand rows pretty quickly, but if you're going to try to move 10 million rows, you might want to consider moving the data. Yeah, so the response was if you're trying to just, say, aggregate some data, that a large chunk that you have in Hadoop, and then be able to access that small kind of result set of aggregation. Yeah, that's a great example. So the example I gave with Progressive, that's exactly what they do. They allow both systems to go run the aggregations and then combine that at the end, and you're streaming a small set of data. If you had something like a bunch of files sitting in your structure that are 5 billion rows, and you want to go process that very fast, your best bet is to pull that into the SQL Data Warehouse system because you get all the benefits of things like cluster column indexing. You get compression. You get all kinds of segment elimination. You're not going to go read everything. So that's really kind of one of the best practices. But it somewhat depends on kind of the configuration of your environment. So now one of the things that I've been talking about is kind of we use Polybase's loading tool today. This is kind of one of the common patterns. One of the big things is Microsoft has introduced Azure Data Lake. Now, how many people are familiar with Data Lake? Looks like all the same SQL DW folks because we talk about it quite a bit. So what Azure Data Lake is, it was a system born inside of Microsoft that we now offer as a public cloud service. And essentially what it is it's a very large-scale Hadoop-like infrastructure. We run this thing internally. We run a variant of it. It came out of the Bing system a long time ago where they were doing all of the telemetry off of internal data sets. So when somebody hits bing.com or runs a query, they log all of that data and went into a central repository. Internally, it was called Cosmos. You can go read about this. There's public documentation about it. And we took what we learned from running that and we introduced it as a cloud service. So Azure Data Lake is this very large scale, very high ingestion rate service. And it sounds just like what it is. You can land whatever you want into the system. And so when we think about things in the cloud, this means that you can go run today at what we call Azure Analytics or Azure Data Lake Analytics over the top of it, which is these batch-based operations. So go parse through 50 petabytes of data with 100,000 nodes and aggregate some result set. And so we have customers at that scale that are loading data very, very rapidly into the system, but being able to take that data and move it in between is something that was up until recently very hard to do. You just use something like Azure Data Factory to move data from one location to another. But that's not that efficient. So what we've introduced is the ability to take Polybase, that technology I just showed you, and actually run that over the top of Azure Data Lake. So you could go land all of your data, no matter where it comes from, in something like Data Lake, and then use Polybase to be either aggregate that data or be able to take that data and ingest it through something like a CTAS statement out of Data Lake, or you know, maybe the aggregated data that you're looking at, and put it into your data warehouse for further analytics. And really the methodology is it's the same as what you saw before. It's this capability of taking all of that data, no matter where it is, landing it in Data Lake, letting, say, if you have a data scientist team work on that data in all of its full raw form, or being able to take some slice of that data. Maybe you don't need second-by-second data sets when you're doing your aggregation for your analytics. Maybe you need day level or hour level or week level. And you can do that aggregation and pull it into something like a managed store like SQL DW for further processing. And the process looks exactly the same. Everything I showed you is exactly the same, with one exception. So when we create the external data source, instead of defining it as something as WASB, you'll now just say ADL. And you can connect your ADL source, and off you go. The entire process is exactly the same with that one change. And now you're able to access all of that data in all of these systems using both of these kinds of technologies. So the question is, you know, would you still use Azure Data Factory to schedule the querying of your data lake? Essentially, I'm paraphrasing a bit. You can. But really, Data Factory is a pipelining tool. Its job is generally to move data from one to the other. More often, what we see is that people will create something like a stored procedure. That's their, if they're going to do something like a scheduled load, using just T-SQL code, generally what they'll do is they'll write it in something like a procedure as a container. And then they'll schedule it with something like Azure Scheduler or Azure Functions or any one of those kind of Azure Automation that allow them to go just execute that on a schedule. Those are really better scheduling components. Yeah, Data Factory is an overkill for just scheduling. And really the idea was you have full control of that data when you define the T-SQL of how you want to move the data, what fashion it moves in, what aggregations you're doing when you move that data, and then just using a cloud scheduler, allowing it to be scheduled whenever you want. It's pretty common. We have customers that do that exact scenario, and they do it, you know, every 5 seconds, once an hour, once a day, kind of depends on their business. With that, I wanted to pivot a little bit into some scenarios. So I wanted to talk about kind of some of the things that we see with customers doing. There's a couple of patterns that are starting to really emerge as the ways that people start to structure their business. So this is a definition of a customer. This is a larger enterprise. What they do is they take all of their traditional data, you know, transactional data you get from your ERP systems, your web ordering systems, all of that kind of stuff. They take all of that data and they load it. In this case, what they do is they load it into a Hadoop cluster. That Hadoop cluster for this particular customer happens to land on-premise. And then they start processing it there. They have a full team of data scientists that are going doing deep analytics across that, and so they do it in the Hadoop environment because they want access to the full raw data. For this case, though, they will take some of that aggregated data. They run some jobs in Hadoop, and they take that aggregated data and they land it in blob storage. This is kind of the design they have today. From there, they use Polybase. To the question just asked a minute ago, they actually schedule it using Azure Automation. It schedules once an hour, and they'll go absorb that data into SQL Data Warehouse. Now, from there, they have a set of kind of data marts. These are different SQL DW instances, and the reason they've done this is they're geo-replicated worldwide. This is a customer that's a multinational company, and they have 5 locations worldwide. And they have different kind of scheduling requirements and data requirements per country. And so they're having to set up individual instances based on the legal requirements of the company or the country they're operating in. But this could be done out of a single instance. From there, they use some other technologies. They use something that we call the Azure Analytic or Azure Analysis Services. Excuse me. It's SSAS cubes. Their tabular format. They use these as caching tiers. They do it because they have very high concurrency stats. In this case, this customer has about 30,000 concurrent customers per region hitting the system. So you can imagine a very large web portal being interacted with constantly. And so you use this as one, both a caching tier, as well as in their environment, all of their engineers, their analysts, their business analysts, all of the people who are consuming this data are very familiar with cubes and Excel. And so when their analytics are done, they want to present that data in a way that their their folks already know how to use. They use the analytics or the analysis services to be able to present that in a way that people are already familiar with. They don't want to retrain all of their employees. So they're laying over the top of that. They use SSRS and in some instances on some of their dashboards, and ultimately they use Power BI, Tableau, Qlik, and a couple other technologies for front-end visualization. So this is a fairly layered architecture, and I wanted to show you the capabilities of kind of putting something together that's kind of complex, and this is kind of how it works. And in this case, they have dedicated divisions of people working on things like data analytics, they have people that are doing base reporting, they have people doing deep data science insights into the data, so it's kind of a very layered architecture. The second architecture that we see is kind of what we call the Lambda architecture. Now, this isn't a Microsoft invention, but it's really the concept of a hot path and a cold path of data. So if you imagine you were running something like Bing.com, you want to know a bunch of information. How many people are hitting the site right now? What's the current traffic level on the site this second? And you want to be able to trend that very fast. You want to be able to see when there's spikes in traffic. So that's the hot path. How fast can I read that data? How fast can I interact with it? Then there's a cold path. How many people have hit this data over the last 7 days? What's our trend in the last month? Do we see seasonality? Like in the U.S., we have the Super Bowl. Or is there, a day where people are hitting specific parts of the site? So those kinds of paths. Now, that's a web example, but there's many others. You can imagine a retailer that's saying, which one of my stores are seeing a surge of traffic? With the introduction of things of human monitoring based on video cameras and the data that's coming out of that, they can see traffic patterns in their store. You can combine that with things like weather data, and you can start to interact with, the store in different ways than you could before. Maybe it starts raining, and so you tell your folks to, start rushing the umbrellas to the front of the store so you can catch people's attention as they're walking by the storefront. Something as simple as that. You want to be able to interact with that data very fast. And so where SQL Data Warehouse plays in this scenario is traditionally in the warm, cold path. It's the large-scale landing of that data and then being able to produce trends over the top of it. The goal of the system is to be able to see that data very fast. And so really in this scenario, what's happening is, this is a real architecture, it's from a real customer, and again, what they do is they have Azure IoT and Event Hubs, which is an ability to ingest kind of IoT-type data being alerted into the system. They do a combination of things. They land that data as raw data directly into a Hadoop cluster that they run in the cloud. They also land it directly into Azure SQL Data Warehouse, so they land it in dual places. Ultimately, in the data lakes, data lake, they just convert it over to data lake. What they do with the data lake side is they run a lot of analytics there. They also just store it. They use it as long-term storage for everything. In their case, they're generating about 10 terabytes an hour of data. And so they want to be able to have that data forever, and they expect that to grow to multi-petabytes in the first 2 years. And so they're just going to store that data. They don't actually work with all of it, so they keep it there as kind of a large-scale history if they ever want to get back to it. They then take some of that data, they aggregate it in particular ways, or they'll take the raw data that lands in SQL DW, and then that goes into the front-end system. In this case, it's a front-end retailer, and their merchandisers will be able to interact with that system, whether that's historical trending, whether that's real-time interactivity of what's going on. Maybe a celebrity posted an Instagram picture that has put, one of your products on the mainstream, and how they maybe have, 100 million followers, and all of a sudden now you have a bunch of people hitting your site trying to get access to that product. Maybe you want to put a sale on, or maybe you want to raise the prices. Whatever you want to do, you're able to do that very quickly. In this case, you can see there's a set of things that they have, things like Power BI, Tableau, Qlik, Excel. That's also it's a kind of common stack. You can see things like semantic modeling with SSAS. They're able to take all of this model and generate data reports that are focused on whether I'm a merchandiser, whether I'm looking at kind of a business segment, whether I'm a manager of a division. I can look at all of kind of what's going on in my system. So I want to show you one last thing. I'm going to flip over to kind of a last demo here. So we've been talking about things kind of in the abstract. We've been talking about things that, a large petabyte scale service, and I've been talking about things in, hey, here's a couple hundred thousand rows. So I thought I would take, kind of the opportunity to show you something a little different. So I'm going to make this duplicate so you can see what I see. And we're going to pivot over to my browser. So I'm going to sign in here. Now, this is an application that was built with the concept of a customer that actually runs a scenario like this, so one of those retailers that I was talking about. Now, they run 5 data warehouses worldwide. This is a real system, and I'll actually prove it in just a minute. And what they run is they run 5 regions. And so we built kind of a mock-up to show you what this looks like. Currently, it supports this instance that you're looking at. It has 3 petabytes of data, 10 trillion rows sitting in it. So quite a large amount of data. And what's important about this is, you know, you can go do kind of different operations across all of this data. Now, this retailer happens to have things kind of geographically distributed because they do things, you know, kind of regionally based. So they don't have all of their worldwide data. But if they ever wanted to get at that data, they could. And so I'm going to actually show you this. Now, a couple things that you'll notice. You can see the scale sizes. So you can see in 4 of the 5 regions, we're running a DW6000, 60 node clusters, very large, very processor intensive. They can do a lot of data. And then we happen to have in the Southeast Asia region a DW400. So in this case, I can actually go turn that thing up, I'm going to scale it up, I'm going to pick Asia and execute. Now what's happening right now is the cluster's resizing. We're going from 4 nodes to 60. And it'll take about 60 seconds. And the idea is that when we want to increase processing power, you can do this essentially on demand. And so we're able to take that cluster and make it much, much bigger. And the idea is that because we've separated your data, we don't have to go move any of your data. Really what we're doing is we're saying the data stays in place, it's secure, it's protected, it's fully redundant. We're able to add compute when we need it, access that data very quickly in a different size. And so you can see it took about 60 seconds. I'll stall it a little bit to get to 60 seconds. So now I'm at a much bigger size. Yeah, your question.
Is the data in one particular region? So if you've got all those systems in another region, you've got to pull the data from that other region?
The question is, all the data in one region? In this example, there are slices of the data. So I have 5 regions, so each one has 1/5 of the data. This one's kind of evenly distributed for the demo. But generally, when you have a data warehouse sitting on data, the data is in that local region, and it's redundant. What I didn't tell you is that the data itself is backed by Azure Blob Storage. We use the same Blob Storage as everybody else. And so the data itself is in triplicate in that data center. And then we have geo-redundant backups capable. So as the system is taking copies of the data for redundancy's sake, that data lives in the data center that it's in. It lives in a pair data center. And you can look at the Blob Storage containers to see where those pairs are. And it's basically copied 9 times across multiple data centers. So your data is always available. In the U.S., we have things like the U.S. West and the U.S. East region, or here in Australia Southeast and East, and those are the pairs. So generally, they're country-based, because a lot of people don't like, you know, data moving out of country.
How long would that generally take?
It takes a while, but the question is, how long does that replication take? As you're ingesting data into the Blob Storage system, it's automatically taking those copies. Like, you're, as an individual running a SQL Data Warehouse, you don't have to worry about that. This is part of the system of Azure Blob Storage, so it happens automatically. Behind the scenes, we also take backups automatically for you. They happen about every 8 hours. And so we take full snaps of your data, and those backups are also stored in that same redundancy model. So if you imagine the worst-case scenario, an entire region goes offline. Say Australia Southeast just disappeared for whatever reason. All of your data is redundant, including the backups in Australia East. So you always have some redundancy of your data. Yeah. Yeah, so when you scale up, we had extra compute nodes for processing.
But when you were defining your data warehouse table, you also decided on how to distribute it, and you said based on the level you're at, it'll decide how many nodes that goes across.
So the question is, when you're defining the table, do you have to define how many nodes it goes across? And the answer is no. Yeah, the system, the way it's set up is the system has a set of distributions. Under the covers, there are actually just individual SQL databases. And so they're laid down into the system. And depending on how many nodes you run, essentially means how many databases are running on an individual physical node. So when we change node sizes here, you can imagine I have 1 node. It's running all of the distributions. Or in this case, I have 60 nodes. So each one's only running a single distribution. So when we scale up, we do not create additional databases. We actually just use those fixed number of distributions that we already have, and the distributions are just repointed. We essentially are creating new compute and attaching it to the storage that already exists.
So when does it decide how many databases to create? Is that when, so when I create my initial table and I define the distribution type, it'll decide on how many underlying SQL databases to create?
Yeah, so the question is, where do I configure the number of distributions, essentially? The distribution model is fixed, so you don't have control over that today. It's essentially the sharding model we build under the covers. The concern is that if you could control the number of distributions, you can, there's not really a lever that makes it efficient for you to do that. We can use all the telemetry we have based on what we see customers doing, and we can kind of tweak that over time. We kind of reserve the right to change that. The model has changed over time from the introduction of the service. We started with a much higher number, and we saw that it didn't give us any performance benefit, and it made things like backups much harder. The coordination of backing up, say, 1,000 databases in parallel all at the same exact second is hard. So we pulled that down, so we got to a level where the performance is there for all customers. We're not over-allocating resources, but allows the system to be able to do it efficiently and other parts of the system to work well. But in the case of thinking about it, really the distribution is not really something for you to worry about, like how the physical data lays down. There's a set of resources on our team, you know, the engineers in our team that are experts at this stuff. Really the thing that is more impactful is the distribution type that you pick, how the data is laid down into those storage containers. That's much more important in this system than it is, you know, how the physical data sits on disk.
I guess what I was wondering is when you scale it up, is it also behind the scenes, is it trying to physically distribute it across extra databases?
Got it. Got it. So the question is, as I scale up, am I trying to essentially redistribute the data into either more or additional distributions? The answer is no. We do everything not to move data. You can imagine if we had 3 petabytes and I tried to move that, how long it would take. This demo would go for a week, me just standing here. Yeah. So the question is, does it support auto-scaling like with web apps? That's kind of the scenario you have. So today, no. Today, what we have is the ability to do all of this stuff through PowerShell, through T-SQL, through REST APIs. It allows you to go schedule that on your own, but we don't have an auto-scaling mechanism. So for those that aren't familiar with it, web apps have this concept of being able to say, I want to scale my service automatically between this range. So I could pick, say, 2 and 10 nodes, and based on, say, a factor like CPU percentage, this is how web apps work, if I hit a certain threshold, it'll start adding nodes up to my kind of window of resources. It just does that automatically. SQLDW today does not. So I'm going to do one last thing here before I pop over to a different scenario, or a different actual part of this system. So I'm going to run a fraud analysis across 10 trillion rows. Anybody want to bet me how long this takes? Any guesses? An hour? 25 minutes? So this is 10 trillion rows. This is real. This is not smoke and mirrors. Yeah. So I'm going to execute this, and what you'll see is as this starts processing, you'll actually see the number of rows start to being processed. So you'll see the elapsed time. Oh, I think I ran the wrong query. Oh, I didn't do it across all locations. I was wondering why that took so fast. So this is going to start processing. And you'll see the number of rows processed, the total rows. In this case, it's a fraud analysis. It's doing an aggregation. That's actually not right. It takes about, let's see if that runs again. It'll take about 3 minutes to run a 10 trillion row query. So I'm going to flip over to SSMS real quick. I don't know what's going on with that. If I connect to one of those instances, this is a real instance that's backing that system, you can see that this particular table, the fraud transactions table, contains 606 billion rows. And so in those 5 environments, in this particular table, it's actually containing that level of rows. And I can run this query. It takes about a minute to run to go do a count. Or I can do something like a select. But this is a table that I can interact with. It's been obviously optimized and tuned for this demo. But really what it is it's a hash-distributed table, and it can run just like anything else. So this is truly a 3-petabyte environment allowing you to run those kinds of queries. Now, in this case, it's running it across multiple environments. So not only is there distribution in an MPP system here on that individual environment, so if you're looking at, say, something like Asia or something like North America, each one of those is an MPP, but we've taken those 3 petabytes and split it across 5. And so we're able to do that in this distributed system. And then the front-end dashboard is supposed to go try and execute the query. I don't know why it's not flipping and running that. So we may try logging out and logging back in. Because I actually want to show you a 3 billion or 3 petabyte query running with 10 trillion rows. So, and when it loads up, you can actually see it's doing row counts. So let's go see if we can do that. Total fraud. See if we get to 4 seconds. There it goes. So it should have taken about 3 minutes. I don't know what's going on with this front-end dashboard. I apologize for that. What's that? Maybe it's faster than I think, but usually it takes about 3 minutes, and it takes about 3 minutes for it to go actually execute that query in parallel across all of those locations, aggregate the data in this web form, and present it back to you. And that's a real demo. So it's a real query that's being run. It's something similar to what I just showed you. And when you start to deal with data at this scale, you can imagine, one, just dealing with 3 petabytes. How do I load that data? How do I manage it? How do I interact with it? How do I query it? And by using the power of this distributed system, we're able to do that very efficiently. We're able to take all of that data, break it down into manageable chunks, and be able to parse through it very, very efficiently. So in this case, with your thinking through the scenario, all of the numbers I've given you, we have essentially 60 nodes running in 5 regions. So 300 nodes trying to process 10 trillion rows. That's essentially how the math's working out here. Yeah? Oh, this one scaled down? Yeah, something's going on with this front-end dashboard. I don't know what's happening here. So that's why the query should be going much. It should still be running, and I should still be talking about it. So something's a little off here with this dashboard. So. Okay, so the question is, as the system scale, is it linear scale? It's near linear. We use a bunch of industry-based workloads. You can imagine what they are. And we have a customer set of kind of representative workloads that we use to kind of measure and perform this. The idea is that we guarantee that a DW setting, so a DW100, DW500, those kinds of things, are a set level of performance. And so as you scale, they're generally near linear. Think in the 97-98% range. Now, there are some workloads that don't parallelize as well. And so if you're doing that, say, running insert, singleton inserts. So if you're just doing inserts, you're just doing insert, that won't scale very well, and so your performance there will be a lot less. And so it just doesn't scale because you're not doing any kind of parallelism. But generally, if you're doing something like a CTAS, you should see parallelism. As the parallelism gets wider with compute, you should see a lot bigger scale. All right, with that, these are the slide I'm supposed to put in there that says, hey, evaluate the session. They did say that there was, before you got, something else that you could get, like the tickets to go to the drone thing. Sorry, I'm not giving away free goodies. But do please evaluate the sessions. It gives the folks that work on the conference itself insight into what sessions worked, what sessions didn't work, things I could do to improve in these sessions. So with that, I'll take any more additional questions. I'll stand up here a little bit and answer any additional questions that you have. Otherwise, thank you very much. I know it's early in the morning on a Friday after a long week of Ignite, so I appreciate you coming to my session. Thank you very much.